The Israel Report for the latest news and insights with Anthony Reich.
Anthony Reich, Shavua Tov. Well, is it Shavua Tov? Because tonight is the Chag. I'm so confused, Anthony. Is it Monday or is it Friday?
I think it's Shavua Tov. I think it's Shana Tova. I think it's Gmar Tov. I think it's all of these things all mashed together, and it's Chag Sameach soon enough, right?
So basically, you can't go wrong as long as you just don't say Mazel Tov.
As long as, well, you can say Mazel Tov, but as long as you don't say Tzomkal, because that's done, right?
That's over. Got it.
We do start the week with the first 100 days of Prime Minister Naftali Bennett's period as Prime Minister coming to an end tomorrow. And there is this thing about the first 100 days, right? Everybody likes to look at the first 100 days and what new leaders, new people in their position have managed to achieve. And interestingly, quite a number of people have tried to compare Naftali Bennett's first 100 days with Joe Biden's first 100 days. I'm not quite sure why they want
to try. Especially because, at least, let's hope Naftali Bennett can remember his first 100 days.
Well, we hope so. But it's interesting that the assessment of his first 100 days is that there's been nothing startling, no major achievements to speak of with Joe Biden. They talk about new legislation that's been introduced, budgets that have been approved, vaccines that have been achieved. With Naftali Bennett, not so much. But one of the main achievements, I think, which has been pointed to as part of his first 100 days, is the fact that he succeeded in proving that there is life after Netanyahu, and that those doomsday predictors who thought that Israel would collapse as soon as Netanyahu left office have all been proven wrong. And perhaps on the contrary, that there's been a certain element of stability that's been restored to the political sphere, to the political spectrum, to the operation of government, and that there is definitely life after Netanyahu, even though Netanyahu is trying to prove that there isn't life after him, and he's got himself into hot water over this parody that he's put out on Twitter, which I think attempts to try to criticize Joe Biden, trying to show that he fell asleep during the meeting with Naftali Bennett. Of course, Netanyahu's office has come out to say, yes, this is definitely not a criticism of Joe Biden, who's been a friend for 40 years. Chas v'chalila, that he should criticize him, but perhaps a criticism of Naftali Bennett that he was willing to put up with such behavior. I'm not quite sure how you reached that.
Maybe he was boring. But either way, look, I was relieved if he was sleeping. I thought he was dead.
Well, apparently he's alive. We have confirmed that. But, there have been rumors about whether he was awake or not. Somehow, and I think a little bit distastefully, in my humble opinion, I think Prime Minister Netanyahu has decided to come out with this little video clip. I'm not sure that he's done himself any favors in the process.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. The story of the prisoners has now concluded the next chapter, and I've got no doubt that this is not the final chapter, because there's going to be a lot of discussion around what happened. But where are we with the story?
Well, so finally, the last two of those six prisoners who escaped from Gilboa prison 2 weeks ago have now been recaptured. They were recaptured yesterday. The story is not a positive story for Israeli security, and certainly not for the prison services. That is for sure. These prisoners have come out and been hailed as heroes. Their images have been drawn up and painted as graffiti on walls across the Palestinian Authority area. Sweets were handed out when it became evident that they had escaped. The contradictory side of that is that the recapture yesterday in the middle of Jenin was done without any bloodshed, without any drama. It certainly showed a certain victory for Israeli intelligence, and I think that even Palestinians who might have supported these prisoners have been forced to admit that Israeli intelligence goes a lot deeper and a lot further than even they might have been able to predict, and they've been forced to acknowledge that this was quite an operation in order to recapture these two remaining prisoners. It was thought that they would be in the middle of the Jenin refugee camp. The Palestinian gunman had warned Israeli security that if they dared come anywhere near Jenin, that they would be confronted with gunfire and with resistance. None of that transpired in the end. It was all a relatively tame affair. The house in which these two guys were holed up was surrounded by Israeli security, and they came out without any resistance. They were recaptured. They're now back in custody. And I think that what has been concluded from this whole operation is that there may well be, I mean, it's not there may well be, but it's really been reinforced more than ever before, that there are informers within that community. And of course, the local citizens of the Palestinian Authority are so opposed to this whole concept of people who are collaborating with the Israeli authorities. But this recapture seems to reinforce more and more that there are collaborators, that there are people who are spying and sending information through to Israeli authorities. It's got to the situation where Israel has even had to set up a separate kind of encampment, a separate place to live for people who have been accused of collaborating with Israel. This is a very, very serious issue and potentially endangers the lives of those individuals if they become known to the local residents. So now the search apparently is on for those informers who might have been involved in giving up the names and whereabouts of these individuals and what they've been up to since they escaped Gilboa prison. But of course, from an Israeli point of view, that intelligence operation very, very successfully executed. And of course, the combat troops who were forced to go into Jenin, which is a real danger area, not a simple place to enter in an Israeli uniform, IDF
was
uniform.
Jenin in some years ago where the two Israeli soldiers were trapped and then killed?
Right, so there was a lynch that took place in Jenin. Yeah, absolutely. It's not a simple place to have to go into, but on this occasion the operation was really brilliantly executed, very, very peacefully done, job done in terms of getting these two guys back into custody. And now, of course, the work will be done to find out how it was that they managed to escape, what happened, what were the weaknesses in the prison services that allowed this to happen. That will be ongoing, and you can be absolutely sure that we have not heard the last word on that by a long way.
I don't doubt that. This is a fascinating one, and I see that it's been reported as well on Business Insider here in South Africa. New reports have surfaced to confirm that the Iranian chief military nuclear scientist was assassinated by the Mossad using a remote-controlled weapon. What new information has come to light, Anthony?
So this has come out again in the New York Times, and of course this involves the assassination of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who we may recall was assassinated back in November of last year. And there were so many rumors about how this was undertaken, what was used, none of which was confirmed. The way that's been reported here in Israel is very fascinating, because the New York Times has run this particular story, and the Jerusalem Post has then taken upon itself to confirm the accuracy of the New York Times story. Now, I'm not exactly sure how the Jerusalem Post is able to come out so decisively to confirm the accuracy of the story. But there you go. We'll just leave that to the Jerusalem Post for them to let us know how they've managed to confirm this. But according to the story that's come out, the actual sniper machine gun that was used was a 7.62mm sniper machine gun. It was apparently hidden beneath tarpaulins and a decoy construction on a truck bed that was on the road that was being taken by Fakhrizadeh to his holiday home, I believe. And he was traveling with his wife and a team of security guards in an escort car. They went to this place called Absard, which is where many of Iran's elite have their second homes, vacation villas, along the road. This whole thing had been set up. Apparently, the weapon itself had been smuggled into Iran in pieces. and had been smuggled into Iran over a number of months because the whole thing together apparently weighs something like a ton. And it had to be smuggled in tiny pieces over many, many months, which was then constructed, which was set up along the road. And apparently the sniper who was responsible for pushing the trigger to assassinate this guy was sitting in Israel at the time. That's how the whole thing worked. A remote control seems to have been now confirmed rather than a physical team. One of the other little snippets which has come out about the story is that there were explosive devices that were then detonated as soon as the assassination had been executed in order to try to destroy all of the evidence, to destroy this gun and to destroy the setup that had been established along the road. And according to the reports, not all of those explosive devices were successful in their explosion. And this left a few little bits of information which the Iranians apparently were able to then use to piece together the story of exactly what happened. There have been no reports of anybody who has been held responsible, not within Iran, and certainly no names that might have been published to give evidence of the fact that the Iranians know exactly who was involved and how it was done. But certainly on the ground, the evidence that was supposed to have been completely destroyed was not entirely destroyed. And of course, now the discussion goes a little bit beyond that assassination itself, which was clearly brilliantly executed. This individual was considered to be key in the nuclear program. There were reports at the time that his assassination would set their nuclear program back at least 5 years. Now, 10 months later, and with Iran apparently only a month away from producing sufficient enriched uranium to produce a nuclear bomb, the question is whether that theory was correct, whether this idea that Israel could potentially set the nuclear program back 5 years was an accurate theory, where 10 months later it seems we are on the verge of sufficient nuclear, sufficient uranium, enriched uranium being produced. I think that that is still an issue where the jury is out and that we cannot be absolutely sure. But there are some people who are saying that the theory is not borne out because of the fact that they're almost on the verge of being able to have enough enriched uranium for the bomb. But certainly the execution of this operation is as fascinating as anything I've come across.
It really is. This has got to be made into a movie. It's just absolutely brilliant.
It's absolutely begging to be made into a movie. I agree, and I have no doubt that someone will pick it up and run with it. But the way that this has all been carried out, interestingly, by the way, the original report that came out making a lot of these statements was the Jewish Chronicle, the UK Jewish Chronicle, which somehow seemed to have a lot of detail about how it was executed. And it seems as if that particular Jewish Chronicle report in February has been proven to be pretty accurate. You know, there was some talk about how accurate it was at the time and where they might have got their information from. But now with the New York Times also publishing this and the Jerusalem Post so confidently confirming that what they've said is true, it seems like the Jewish Chronicle really had it spot on.
That's amazing. A couple of questions and comments from listeners that I wanted to get to before we talk about Sukkot. Dear Anthony and Howard, Ariel Lani won the bronze medal at the prestigious Leeds International Piano Competition. That's from Ruth Friedman. That's amazing. I wasn't aware of that.
I was not aware of that either, so thank you, Ruth, for that piece of information.
Absolutely. And Rene says, hi, Howard, please can you ask Anthony if he knows what percentage of farmers will keep the Shemitah year, and how do you find out where to shop?
So Shemitah is a whole discussion unto itself. There's so many different ways that Shemitah is being observed in Israel. I did refer to it a few months
Maybe
ago.
Maybe just mention what it is for anybody who's a bit confused by the word.
Shemitah is this concept that in the seventh year of in the land of Israel, that the land should lie fallow and that we should not be allowed to use produce, to consume produce that has been harvested in Israel during the entire period of this year, the entire year, from last Rosh Hashanah until next Rosh Hashanah is when Shemitah is due to continue. And as a result of that, a whole raft of new provisions have been introduced from the kashrut perspective. Kosher food is not the kashrut sign will not be allowed, will not be given to produce that is actually harvested in Israel, even though in any other year it might be fully kosher. This year it won't be kosher because of the fact that it's being harvested in Israel during the Shemitah year. And so there are many things that are being done in order to try to backfill that situation. There are some people who notionally sell their land to non-Jews and then continue to harvest it on the basis that it's not owned by Jews and therefore it's not subject to Shemitah. There is a lot of import of produce that's coming from outside of Israel in order to supplement the supplies. Lots and lots of things. Perhaps we'll have a separate discussion about Shemitah. But
so,
just to answer Rene, there are, I mean, you go into a grocery shop, any vegetable or fruit store in Israel, any supermarket, and you can ask the questions, and there are labels on things as to how Shemitah is being observed, and just a simple discussion with the people will be able to give you the answer. But as a general rule, supermarkets are required to observe Shemitah, and many of the green grocery stores in Israel as well.
Absolutely. It is 8 o'clock. Anthony Reich, wishing you a Chag Sameach. Although it's not Chag for you on Wednesday, you still get to take the day off, and we'll see you on Thursday.
I look forward to it. I wish everybody a Chag Sameach. I hope that you'll be able to enjoy time in Sukkot. Lots and lots of Sukkot stories. We'll talk about that on Thursday. But in the meantime, I hope that everybody will be able to enjoy a good Chag and enjoy the things that are normally done. It's very, very nice to get out and enjoy company of people in the outdoor Sukkot, and that's, I hope, what everybody will be doing. Chag Sameach to you all.
Absolutely right. Anthony Reich, thank you. As always, Chag Sameach. It is 8 o'clock. I'm Howard Feldman. Good morning.